はい。So it's good to be here. Nice to see you all. My name is Susan Nelson. Some of you haven't met me before. Tim said I should introduce myself. So. And I'm one of the teachers here. I've been practicing here at Minnesota Zen Center as a priest for almost 8 years. And now I live at Hokyoji Zen Practice Community, which is a lovely place, and you're all invited to visit anytime. So please come. And we just had a retreat there. Some of you were there, and some of you couldn't make it. And it was a lovely retreat, and Tim was actually there, which was great. And we co-taught the retreat. And it was a lovely time. Autumn is just coming to the land, so there were a lot of colors, and we took a lot of nature walks. Just really great. So getting here this morning was pretty fun. Forgot about the marathon. Traveling from the west side of Lake Harriet, from Rosemary Taylor's house. Trying first this route. Oops, can't get through there. Then the next route. Finally, we went to 62 Crosstown. We made it here on time. So today's talk, I'm going to talk today about the student-teacher relationship and stages of practice, even though there aren't any stages of practice. So just forget about it right away, right now. So Joko Beck, she's one of my favorites. She's no longer alive, but her teaching in her books, of course, lives on. She says, "We don't usually see that we're all teachers. Everything we do from morning to night is a teaching." So that's true. We're all just transmitting the Dharma or the truth or our understanding of it from morning to night. We can't help it. But usually, most of us, when we first come to Zen practice, we're looking for somebody to show us, you know, to kind of be a mentor, a coach, or a guide, because we don't know what's happening at these places. We don't know what to do, and we want to figure out the rules and the etiquette and the protocol so we don't feel awkward. You know, so a teacher is kind of helpful. And new parents of babies, infants, are pretty impressed by this. You know, Tim talked at the retreat about imprinting, how our teachers imprint on us, how Suzuki Roshi imprinted on him, how Katagiri Roshi imprinted on him, Katagiri Roshi imprinted on me, and Tim imprinted on me. So that's what's happening with our teachers, kind of, you know, and it's what's happening with parents and their babies. And it's such an awesome responsibility, pretty scary for a new parent to realize that everything they're saying, they're doing, and their facial expressions, the sound of their voice is just going right into the child, you know. So, woof, it's a scary thing, you know, for a new parent. So anyway, we're looking for some guidance, and I think the beginning of wisdom or prajna in Zen practice is understanding how little we actually know. You know, at any stage of our practice, you know, not just when we first walk in the door and sit down for the first time and hear a Zen talk with a lot of concepts and Sanskrit and Japanese names sprinkled in, not just those first talks we hear, but at every stage of our practice. So that's, you know, if we've been sitting for a couple years, if we've done a Zen initiation like some of you did recently, or if we've just been ordained a priest or had Dharma transmission, it's always a sense of not knowing. So much more that we don't know than we know. You know, it's very vast. The teachings are vast. and this life is vast and mysterious. We don't know, and we won't know everything. If we know everything, we're actually dead. We're not alive to the Dharma of the moment. So I love autumn because it's a time when the leaves are changing. Impermanence is just all around us, and it's so, and yet it's so alive. Things are starting to die, and as they're dying, they're changing color, and they're so beautiful. They're so beautiful. And it's like that not only with trees and leaves, but people too. Sometimes when people are in the dying process, they sort of bloom. They sort of, their true colors come out. And it's a beautiful thing to witness, and it's a great teaching for all of us at times like that. And the leaves just let go. They turn color, they blossom out. Who knows what's happening chemically? Maybe some of you know about that stuff, but it's okay to be a mystery for me. I know that something's happening, you know, something that had to do with how much rain and, you know, how cold it is and what kind of a summer we had, whether there was a dry spell in there. I don't know. Lots of causes and conditions, but leaves let go and they just float to the ground. And it's just a beautiful thing, and it's a teaching for us. So for me, nature's been a big teacher. One of my teachers in this life is nature. And another thing Joko Beck says is that all of practice is simply happening within our senses. It's what's coming into our senses and the pure perception of that. So we don't usually experience pure perception. We can. And sometimes it looks like children are. It looks like babies are. And we can. We do experience pure perception. But usually there's a lot of evaluation going on. You know, that's what we get in touch with. That's what we're doing when we're sitting and when we're not sitting. You know, doing a lot of evaluation rather than purely perceiving what is. I've just been reading this book, and it's a wonderful book called The Last Child in the Woods. Has anyone heard of that? Have you? Yeah. It's a great book about, they coined a phrase called nature deficit disorder, you know, in relation to what's happening with our kids, you know. That our kids are spending a lot of time indoors and they're spending a lot of time online, and you know, they don't have the vast stretches of space to explore that some of us did growing up, and that there's something lost there because the senses are tuned by nature. Nature sharpens the senses, and studies are showing that that affects creativity and learning. So not only for children, but us, you know, it's important. So that's one important teacher for me, a teacher that I now am fortunate to be present with daily. But as far as our Zen teachers, we often idealize them at first. Especially teachers of the stature of Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi. Some of us used to watch their every move, you know. I remember thinking that one time that he could read my mind, you know. And other people said those things too. And, you know, we thought, you know, completing the 10 powers. We thought that they had superpowers, you know. They must. And during Sesshins, you know, they would really express themselves exuberantly, and you saw a whole other side of them, you know, that wasn't so obvious in day-to-day life. So we thought that they were really something, and we projected quite a bit on them. So that's one of the things a teacher will do, is accept their students' projections. You know, we see someone who appears to be quite advanced, someone like Katigiri, someone like Tim at times. And we project onto them all of our own clarity, all of our own wisdom and compassion and our finer qualities. And that's an important thing to be able to do, you know, in working with a teacher, because it means that there's trust there. And that you allow yourself in this one area of your life, in your Zen practice life, to really follow this person, really trust them, you know. And some of that involves projecting onto them. So they agree to take those projections, and then later they give them back to you, generously and kindly. They hand them back in various ways with skillful means. So at first, what we see in them is what we can't completely see in ourselves. We can't completely take responsibility in ourselves. You know, that's part of it, you know. And we bring into our practice life our idealizations about what a spiritual person should be like and what a spiritual teacher should be like. We have a lot of shoulds. We put shoulds on ourselves and shoulds on our teachers and shoulds on our fellow practitioners. I should be always wise and compassionate. I should not be angry. I should be, you know, et cetera, yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of things that we think of. There's a lot of pictures we have about what a spiritual person is that come from, who knows, you know, popular culture, our early religious training. So that's part of it. So that's, I call that stage two, deciding to work with a teacher, seeing our projections, seeing our conditioning, seeing what we bring into it and what actually is, allowing ourselves to trust this person that we choose to be our teacher. So that's stage two in my scenario. And stage one is just getting through the door, like many of you have done today. Just getting through that door and sitting down for the first time, or for your first, your second time, or your third time, and doing zazen and listening to a talk and coming back again. And the pre-path stage, so we're going backwards, okay? Going backwards. The pre-path stage is just noticing that you're kind of uncomfortable in some way in your life. You might be, you need to improve yourself, you know? Don't feel like you're living up to your potential, or you know, you're in distress of some kind, you know. So that's the pre-path stage. Or you're completely oblivious, but you're getting feedback from people that that it's time to wake up and pay attention. So anyway, that's what the pre-path stage is, what brings us to stage one, just getting through the door. And then stage two is deciding, I think this might be right for me. I'm going to give this a try, and I'm going to try to work with a teacher and see what happens. Yeah. So that's a good place to be, beginner's mind. Beginner's mind. So stages 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, etc., etc., into infinity are all about working with our dualistic thinking, our emotional conditioning, our reactiveness, our confusion, our delusion, greed, our anger, all that stuff that's what all those stages are about. And just sitting with the basic human condition and seeing it arise and letting go of it again and again and again. Seeing it arise and letting go, coming back again and again to just what is happening right here. You are senses, pure perception. So, I hope that doesn't bum you out, but that is what's happening. Which isn't to say that we don't wake up to what's really happening more and more, you know. But the only way to get to a place of living with joy and awakeness more and more every day and responding from that rather than from our reactions is to sit with ourselves. So sit with what comes up over and over again. And we don't even know that stuff is there usually until we sit down and then it starts to arise. That's when we want to have a teacher or a guide or a good Zen friend to help us figure out, you know, what's going on. Help us see what our delusions are about our level of enlightenment. Whatever our delusions are. So I've been looking at this book lately and it's kind of fun, actually. It's a book, it's called The Recorded Sayings of Zen Master Joshu. His Chinese name was Chao Chao. And he was a contemporary of Lin Qi, who was the founder of modern-day Rinzai, and of Tozan, who was the founder of modern-day Soto. So he was one of these legendary persons of Zen from the Tang Dynasty. And this book has a lot of just interactions that kind of show the ways that a master worked with their student back in ancient times. So it's kind of fun. And there's examples of both grandmotherly mind, that way of working with the student, caring and nurturing, you know, pat your head, and also challenge, you know, sort of the sword that cuts through the delusion. So I'll read you a couple of these. A monk said, "What about someone who does not follow anything that is peripheral?" The master said, "Who are you?" The monk said, "Hui Yan." The master said, "What did you ask?" The monk said, "About someone who does not follow anything peripheral." The master patted him on the head. "Good boy. That's all right, you know." Here's a little different approach. A monk asked, "What is the fact of the handing on of the rope?" The master said, "Don't deceive yourself." He's talking about Dharma transmission, the transmission of the Dharma. What is the fact of this handing on of the rope? Don't deceive yourself. Here's a couple more. A monk asked, "What about it when I'm not chasing after various things?" The master said, "Obviously, it's just like this." The monk said, "Isn't this the fact of my own nature?" The master said, chasing. See what I mean? They're kind of fun. I've read these some of these encounters in the past and really felt for the student, the monk, you know, when the master takes the sword out and cuts through. And I just kind of tremble. Ooh, you know, it's rough. That's rough. The master instructed the assembly, saying, "The true way is without difficulty. Just refrain from picking and choosing. To talk about it even a little is picking and choosing. Yet, I'm not within pure clarity. In what place can you see the patriarch?" Pure clarity, the footnote says, means like the state of non-discrimination, you know, oneness. "In what place can you see the patriarch?" A monk asked. "You're not within pure clarity, so what place are you attentive to?" The master said, "I don't know either." The monk said, "You yourself do not know, so how can you say you are not within pure clarity?" So smart, isn't he? The master said, "Your question has been good. Now make your bows and retreat." he's like, "Very good. Now move along." So actually, all of these, I think now I'm realizing, are examples of grandmotherly mind, you know, because what a kind thing, you know, is to be shown in the moment, right there, where you're coming from when you're obviously deluded about it. That can really be helpful. Let's see. Okay, one more, just one more. The master entered the hall, and after sitting quietly for a while, he said, "Is everyone here or not?" Someone said, "Everyone's here." The master said, "I'm waiting for one more to come, then I'll speak." A monk said, "I'll tell you that you're waiting for a person who does not come." The master said, "It's a person that's really hard to find." Whoa. So there's a number of these recorded sayings books. It's one of the genre of the literary tradition of Zen, and they're fun to play with. And they're illuminating. So let's see. So growth happens in practice. You know, we move from a self-centered motivation to start with for what we want out of practice and what we need to get, to practicing more and more for the general good, for what's best for everyone, you know, including us. You know, so that's the bodhisattva way of life, but it's just step by step. You know, one step and one step and one step. And we're perfect just the way we are, and that's the role of a Zen teacher, is to reflect back to us our Buddha nature, which is a way of saying our perfect clarity, our wisdom and compassion, which is innate. That's what we call Buddha nature in Zen and in Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. And then we eventually get to the place where we can see everything as our teacher, and every experience that we encounter as a teaching, you know, if we need to rely on that, maybe we can just be with it, just have pure perception of it, just be with it, just be open. But if that's too hard, and we can get rocked to our toes sometimes by life's experiences, then we can see it, kind of embrace it as a teaching. Maybe not immediately, but soon we can go to that place of seeing whatever comes up, however horrific, and sometimes horrific things happen to people. But we can see it unfolding, because even in the horrific scene, sometimes what unfolds out of it is some pretty incredible things and some wisdom for us. So another thing that Joko Beck says about enlightenment is that it's just being here without anything extra, without drama. And certainly that's relatively a peaceful place to be, you know. And there's joy in it. But she said, you know, you might actually find it kind of boring. There's not much drama to it. Anyway, it's never ending. While we're alive, is this process of being with what is and seeing what we're contributing and just seeing it and letting go of it, just seeing it and letting go of it. Being with it helps it kind of melt away, maybe temporarily, but it does. It melts it in a way that talk therapy doesn't do. And that leads to joy in living. Joy. So, this will be a short talk, but the last thing I want to leave you with is advice from the sixth ancestor. I've been hanging out with the ancestors lately, and that's been kind of fun. So let's see, where is that? Did I? Here it is. It's from something called, it's from the Platform Sutra, and it's called the Song of Formlessness. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just a couple of the stanzas. Enlightenment is already pure. The thought of it is a delusion. But inside delusion is purity. Once truth removes the three obstructions, if you follow the way in this world, let nothing block your path. Paying attention to your own mistakes will keep you in step with the way. People who truly follow the way don't consider the faults of the world. Those who consider the wrongs of the world only add to their own. I don't condemn the faults of others. My own wrongs are what I'm after. Just get rid of thoughts about wrongs, and all your afflictions will shatter. So that's the last word from Hui Ning, the sixth ancestor of our tradition. For today, anyway, it's the last word. Because you have to say something. You have to say something. So that's what I said. Had to say. How about you, Ben? What do you have to say?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Hi, Scott.
Heard on NPR's Science Friday, the tree actually rejects a leaf.
Ah, really?
It forms a film at the end of its branch. It's just one cell layer of twig. And thus, the leaf falls from the tree because it's forced to go.
Forced to go. Yeah, oh, I like that. I like that too, you know. Forced to go. Right? We're forced to go. Constantly forced to go. Like you said, as adolescents, as kids, our own inner development forces us to go. Leave the home of our parents and set out into the great world. Yeah. Neat, thanks. Hi.
I was struck by your phrase, it was something really effective. We all sort of show up here knowing that we're not quite right, or something is lacking. For me personally, I show up feeling broken, hoping that someone will fix me. It really was this self-centered freedom, making me better, making me happy. A more effective and outside influence, making my insides feel good. We're almost like telling a story. Okay, I just show up, hoping someone will fix me, and then at some point, I let go of my ideas of wrong or brokenness. And it's just sort of okay. It's still tragic sometimes and painful, but more and more okay.
Yeah, thanks. That's really honest. That's really what. If we were all that honest, we would all say that's what we, at some point, and maybe still are looking for, is for somebody else to make things all right for us and to take care of us. And, you know, it's the way it is. And but it's also that, you know, we discover that we're all right, you know, the way we are. We're perfect the way we are, and we can use a little improvement. But, you know... But we're willing to work there with our own stuff. you know.
That's pretty
good.
I just like to say that I'm pretty new to Zen and Buddhism, but I feel like I've been living it all my life. I feel like when I walked in this door for the first time last fall, I knew that I was home. I knew that I found everything that had been happening inside of me for all of my life seemed to be here. And when you were talking about dying and how it changes colors, my mother passed away 2.5 years ago, and she was pretty sick for a long time, but her true colors started to come. It was amazing. I think these films, it was the most amazing experience to be there for that. And I also wanted to mention that as a recovering addict, what you read in the end there was spiritual. Exactly what I'm trying to do in my program. I've had a couple of experiences in the last week that could have been talked out in talk therapy, but I decided to sit with and just let them be and let them stir around, and will be hope they resolve themselves.
That's great. That's great. Thanks. Yeah, and we're all addicts, by the way. I mean, you know, on a certain level, you know, we are just addicted to the way we want things to be. And that's a fundamental human problem, you know, not to downplay your struggle, you know, I'm sure it was. But, and I don't want to say that talk therapy is, there's anything wrong with it at all. I think it's really helpful. It's just at some point, it's good to try what you tried and see what happens. You know, with small things, right? Yeah. Right, but don't ignore it either. Yeah. Well, anybody else have a comment or question? Andrea, it's nice to see you. I haven't seen you in a while. Oh, thank you. Thanks. Thanks very much. Okay.
Good. You said earlier talk about how leaves changing colors are beautiful. What makes this physical act of a leaf turning a color? What in the human brain makes it beautiful?
Yeah, what in the human brain? Yeah.
What is this perception, this changing of colors that is coming through our eyes and going to our brain? What makes it beautiful? I mean, I love fall. I love the change of colors. But what is it in our brain that makes it pleasant?
Yeah, we're evaluating it, right?
Right.
We're perceiving it, and then we're evaluating it, and I don't know about you, but it sounds like at least the two of us have come up with the evaluation that it's beautiful and that we like
right.
it, that it's pleasant.
Is it something we're conditioned in thinking that this is supposed to be beautiful?
I'm not sure, but I know that. I've done a study on myself, and I've studied the effect of color on myself, and it definitely leads to positive endorphins, mm-hmm. color, you know, in the spring when the flowers come up, the colors that I paint the inside of my house, you know, the colors I choose to wear on any given day, it has an effect on my endorphins, and I pay attention to my endorphins because I have seasonal affective disorder. So I'm in touch with my endorphins. But yeah, there are people that associate fall with get really melancholy at this time of year, you know? So for them it's a different, something else is happening, you know? They're caught in an idea perhaps of that, oh, they're rushing ahead to winter and it's going to get cold, it's already cold, you know, all that kind of stuff. We can do that with it too, and I used to do that. But yeah. Sure.
You know, chimpanzees will sit there and watch the setting sun.
Mm.
I just imagine that. It's just mm-hmm. not human.
Yeah.
It seems to be a deep evolutionary, you know, something in us that is drawn to colors like that.
And we feel awe or wonder, you know. Joko Beck also says, if you know, you're one of the signs of a mature practice is the ability to see the wonder, you know, even in something that's not considered so great. Like when the Iraq War broke out, I felt, you know, they called it shock and awe. Well, awe and wonder are very close, you know. So wonder, you know, you wonder about something that's that chaotic and that overwhelming and that powerful, you know. But those things are all connecting. We have that capacity to feel wonder, and let's not lose it, you know. And it sounds like chimpanzees do also have the capacity to, you know, just to stare at something like a sunset for a long period of time. Okay, well, thanks. This was very fun for me, and it's really nice to see you all. And now we should do the next thing. Right?